Good afternoon to everybody, or good morning, wherever you happen to be. And welcome to this Berg and Oneida Associates and Heathrow Policy Association webinar on the proposed European Union Directive on Gender Pay Transparency. While it's a new directive, what it really is seeking to do is to make more effective existing directives on gender pay and gender pay equality that go back many years. But in so doing, it introduces a whole new level of complexity into the situation. So we're looking at gender pay transparency for job seekers. We're looking at an obligation on employers to give information to employees and to employee representatives. We're looking at a new obligation on employers to report gender pay gaps. And when that gender pay gap turns out to be more than 5% in any particular category of worker, then there's an obligation, there will be an obligation on the employer to get together with employee representatives to discuss how that gap is going to be closed. But that, of course, immediately opens questions such as, what do we mean by a category, a group, a grade? So how do we what are the metrics and what are the parameters in which we're going to be working? And of course, it also opens up the question, and we've already seen surface in Spain with the Spanish equality legislation. What do we mean by employee representatives? And what happens if you don't have employee representatives? Who are you supposed to get together to discuss how you close this gap with? Questions arise also of compensation for workers who believe they have been discriminated against because of gender pay gaps. And potentially, I think we're seeing the possibility of almost class actions in this regard, because equality bodies or worker representatives will be entitled to bring proceedings on behalf of workers, as well as initiating such claims themselves. And ultimately, of course, in all of these circumstances, the burden of proof will be on the employer to show that they were not discriminating. To discuss these matters with us over the next hour, and it's a lot to get through in an hour, I'm delighted to have with me my old friend Chris Engels from Claeson Engels, the leading Belgian law firm, and he's joined by his colleague, and I can never quite sure if I always get these Belgian names correctly pronounced. Chris, I can do, but Inger Verheist joined Chris from Claeson Engels. I'm delighted also to have with us Ian Stark, who's formerly with IBM for quite a long time on compensation and benefits, and he spent some time with BIC, the French company, and he's starting a new position on global compensation and benefits with another French company in the immediate future. And with me from Oneida Associates, who's based in France. Again, correct me, Veronique. Now, I know I get the Veronique bit right, but it's the Villoy bit, if I'm not sure I've got right, and Alain Moret. Veronique is with Coca-Cola European Partners, and Alain is with Oneida Associates as a senior advisor. And of course, I've got my old friends, Henry Eckelberg from HR Policy. Now, that's the young Henry, not the old Henry.
The old Henry's playing golf right now. He's having a good day.
Well, there you go. And I've also got with me Annie Wang, who's Senior Vice President with HR Policy. And the reason they're with us is because at the same time as we're looking at this Gender Pay Transparency Directive in the EU, they are looking at a Paycheck Fairness Act in the United States, which runs sort of like on the same track and in parallel. So the major multinational companies we deal with are going to be looking at much the same issues on both sides of the Atlantic. So the way we're going to do this is that Chris and Inger are going, everybody's working to a tight timetable here. So Chris and Inger are going to kick off. Then we're going to have Henry and Annie come in to do a little bit of comparison as to the US as against what we're looking at in Europe. Ian is going to come in then and say, hey, these are the things you should be looking at now. These are sort of data you should be generating. These are the sort of metrics you should be thinking about. And then Veronique and Alain will come in and talk about, and in terms of approaching employee representatives, what should you be thinking about? And hopefully all of that will leave us some time for some questions and answers as we tackle this. I suspect this is not the last time we'll be talking together about this issue. The directive still has to go through the Council of Ministers of the European Parliament. And as always happens with any legislation, as it goes through the process, it gets changed, amended. Sometimes it gets watered down, but sometimes it gets toughened up. So when we eventually see the final product, we'll come back to this. But for the moment, Chris, Inder, I'll hand it over to you. What exactly are we looking at here?
Well, thanks. I will take off for the first 5 minutes and then Inger will take over. It is interesting, Tom, that you say it is a directive or a draft directive, a proposal to make the other equal treatment directives maybe more efficient, because I think there's more in there than just the efficiency of the other directives. We know equal pay initiatives and equal pay provisions have been part of the treaty even since 1957, before some of us were born, Tom. And
sorry, some of us, you're talking about yourself there, right?
No. But the thing is that, as far as I'm concerned, equal treatment has always been a very important provision, and you can go to the next slide, a very important provision within the EU. But what I always thought of was that the European Court of Justice has always stressed that we are talking about equality of opportunities. And even when we were talking about affirmative action, that the European Court of Justice looks at it in function of opportunities rather than as results. When I look at the draft or the proposal on pay transparency, and of course you cannot be against any form of pay transparency, but I think that this proposal goes more in the direction of an equality of results than of opportunities itself, and therefore I think it's much more than a mere implementation of the provisions that already existed. This pay transparency directive is said to be part of a wider initiative, of course, which is just to be supported, initiatives on work-life balance and on board presence of women. And then the introductory part to the proposal says that there are only moderate costs involved in this pay transparency directive and living up to its obligations. I think references are made to amounts in between 800 and 1500 euro per company. I think this is a ridiculous estimate, because I think that if you really look at the provisions and the obligations that result from it, that the costs will, of course, be much higher than that. When we talk about pay transparency, of course, one of the key notions is pay. And there we have an abundance of case law of the European Court of Justice that deals with the issue and that really looks at pay in an extremely wide sense. Anything which is paid, and the definition is taken over in the draft proposal, anything which is paid directly or indirectly in exchange for the work that's being performed. The considerations refer to anything that's due on the basis of legislation or collective bargaining agreement. I think that definition is not wide enough. Certainly, if you look at the case law of the European Court of Justice, they consider pay to be anything which is paid basically in exchange for work performed, even if it's ex gratia payments. And I think the considerations also explain that bonuses and everything have to be included in the definition of pay. Then it also highlights that intersectional discrimination is definitely also a form of sex discrimination, meaning when sex discrimination is combined with another discrimination on the basis of a prohibited criterion, and the example is given discrimination against migrant women, that this intersectional discrimination has to be considered under directive as sex discrimination. So the fact that you can refer to another criteria that explains differences, but it's another prohibited criteria, then of course it doesn't take away from the fact that we are dealing with sex discrimination. And then what for me, at least as a lawyer, looks like the most difficult part of the whole directive is the definition and the obligations with respect to comparable work or work of equal value. I think it's going to be extremely difficult how to define that. And of course, when you read the reports that lead up to this proposal, it talks about the fact that the member states hadn't done enough in furtherance of the previous directives in the area of comparable work and work of equal value, because that was already also mentioned in the 75 directive, I think, on equal pay. It's, of course, because there is not much guidance from the European Court of Justice either. The European Court has referred to some objective criteria, but if you really look at the cases, most of the cases deal with facts where the parties to the case accepted that the work that they were looking at was work of equal value. We find now in the directive that you have to define categories of workers on the basis of work for equal value, and you have criteria, the objective criteria, educational, professional and training requirements, skills, effort and responsibility, work undertaken, and the nature of the tasks involved. These are indeed objective criteria, but how how much value are you going to attach to these criteria, which is very unclear for me, and how are they going to work together in order to see whether work is really of equal value or not? And then, of course, the big question remains, once you apply all these criteria and you have comparable work, what is the effect going to be of a criterion like seniority? And I think the European Court of Justice has, for most criteria where we make distinctions with respect to pay, required some legitimate objective explanation why the criteria is used, and has been pretty lenient with respect to the role of seniority in determining pay. I wonder whether, if this directive passes, whether seniority is going to continue to get the same kind of lenient treatment from the European Court of Justice, where the court basically accepts that the fact that you're in the job over a longer period of time is an acceptable explanation why you make more money. I think for quite a lot of jobs, quite a lot, if not most, seniority, certainly after a couple of years, is not bringing in any added value anymore. And then an explanation with respect to comparable work, and then I pass over to Inger, because I'm exceeding my 5 minutes, I think. The valid comparator that can be used on the basis of the case law of the European Court of Justice, it's not necessarily a single employer, but there's a condition attached to it that there's a single source of setting the conditions as a requirement in order to compare beyond the same employer. There is also an indication that you don't have to compare, and that was already established also in the case law of the European Court of Justice, not necessarily have to compare with somebody who is currently still working for the employer. And now even admitted in the text of the draft that you can compare to a hypothetical comparator, which for me is a really strange issue to compare with somebody hypothetically, unless, of course, you can already make your case of direct discrimination, but then we don't need this anymore.
Okay, Chris, before I bring in Inger, can I just bring in Annie, because I know she's got to go to another meeting at 4:30. But Annie, based on what you've been hearing Chris say, where does this stack up against the Paycheck Fairness Act? Are we looking at the same sort of issues here?
So, you know, I think that one of the major areas where Europe and the U.S. differ when it comes to equal pay and paycheck fairness is that in the U.S. up until now, you know, the focus has really been on equal pay for equal work. So I know that, you know, you've got this here about in terms of how do you define comparable work, work of equal value. So in the U.S., you know, and the Paycheck Fairness Act, you know, really is focused on A, it's focused on equal pay for equal work, but B, it's really focused on, I mean, not surprising to anybody, it's focused on litigation in the U.S. So, you know, we already have laws that prohibit companies from discriminating in pay. So the Paycheck Fairness Act is really about making it easier for lawsuits to be successful against employers on gender pay discrimination and prohibiting sort of salary history inquiries, prohibiting employers from limiting their employees from discussing wages, you know, enhanced penalties for violations of the Equal Pay Act, and just really increase class action litigation. But that bill in the U.S., although it's passed the House of Representatives, it's not likely to pass the Senate. I mean, we don't expect it to. It did not have what we call bipartisan support. So it didn't have the support of both Democrats and Republicans. But in the U.S., much of this is really being accomplished in the private sector via investor pressure and employee pressure. And so, you know, rather than go the legislative route in the U.S., I think we're far more likely to wind up kind of farther along the path of where we are now, which is that large investors are, you know, explicitly saying that if you don't disclose a pay gap, for example, if you don't disclose, rather than focusing on pay gap, if you don't disclose the percentage of women who are in your highest paid positions, that's another way of getting a pay gap. If you don't disclose that, we'll vote against your comm committee chair. You know, we'll vote against your nomgov, your nominating and governance committee chair. So that's, I think, how change is going to be enacted in the U.S. I don't see it happening via legislation like this. We also just very recently, the SEC, which regulates companies and what companies have to disclose in the U.S., sort of indicated that one of their top priorities is going to be increased human resources type disclosures, including diversity disclosures. And so an SEC mandate there could achieve the same end by saying, you know, not that we're going to get into definitions of pay and things like that. We almost don't need to. If we can force you to disclose just purely the percentage of women who work in the most senior roles in your company versus the junior roles, we'll get a very good sense of how highly paid women must be and what your overall sort of pay gap must be. And so I think from there could get into something like what they have in the UK, where instead of looking at equal pay for equal work, you're actually looking at average female versus male pay across the organization based on job level.
What about Annie? And I'll come back to Henry later in this conversation on these things, because I know you've got to be away to do.
Yeah, thank you.
What about executive orders? You know, pressure from the executive to make these things happen irrespective of primary legislation.
Yeah. So I think we could see an executive order. We haven't really heard much about that. Vice President Kamala Harris, when she was actually running for president in her own campaign, she had a proposal on pay equity that was actually very similar to the law that exists already in Iceland. And that essentially would have required that federal contractors would have to provide an upfront certification that they have equal pay for equal work. And if they didn't, they could be penal. If a federal contractor, they couldn't get a contract for anybody else. If that happened, it would mean that they would be penalized. They would have to pay a fine per percent of pay gap. But I think, again, that is not far enough for a lot of investors in the U.S. and kind of where the community seems to be going there, because that is still talking about equal pay for equal work. And so, you know, most 99% of legislative proposals that we see are about equal pay for equal work. And I'm seeing the shift in the U.S. to focus on sort of overall pay gaps, because there's a feeling that, you know, okay, so you pay hourly workers, you know, equal pay for equal work, fine. But that still doesn't help the fact that overall, you know, the average man in your company gets paid way more than the average woman because you don't have enough women in senior high paid positions. It's a representation issue. So that I've kind of seen the focus shift there. When it comes to executive orders, I think it'd be more likely for the executive order to say you have to disclose the percentage of women and ethnic minorities at each level in your company.
So what you're actually saying, Annie, is that whether it's legislative action, executive orders, or pressure from investors and shareholders and whatever, the word is transparency. Put it all out there. Tell us what it looks like. How many women have you got up and down the organization at what levels?
Yeah. Yep. I think that's exactly right.
And that's where we're heading. And so if I come to you, Inger, is that the way you're beginning to read things in Europe as well?
Yeah, I think so. So going back to the content of the draft directive, I think Chris and I defined four key takeaways, four important consequences for employers coming from that new draft directive. And the first one is, as you already mentioned also, Tom, that employers will have to be very transparent already prior to the start of employment, which is very new. At least in Belgium, it's very new. So it means that information will need to be provided on the pay level or the pay range. It will need to be easily accessible and available. And ideally, it would already be mentioned in the job vacancy. So the applicant will not really have to request for it. And also, what is new, that it will not be allowed for the employer to inquire about pay history, which I think is really still very common practice to do in Europe nowadays. Secondly, there will be a transparency obligation also during employment, meaning firstly that workers will be able to ask for their individual pay level on an annual basis, and employers will need to inform workers of that right regularly. They will also need to provide information on criteria that determine career progression, which I think nowadays is not that transparent either. And then, of course, large companies, and that's companies of at least 250 employees or more, will need to report annually on 7 items regarding the pay gap on a general basis, so the difference in pay between male and female workers, but also per category. And 6 of the 7 items will need to be published annually on the company's website. And if at least there is a pay gap in any category of at least 5%, then the company and together with jointly with worker representatives will need to carry out what they call a joint pay assessment. They will need to do a thorough analysis, find out whether the difference in pay can be justified, and if not, measures will have to be defined to remedy the differences.
Can I just ask you one question there, Inger? When we talk about pay disclosure, we're talking about pay ranges. We're not talking about the pay of individual workers.
No, it's per, there are general numbers. So for all workers, but you also need to define the pay gap per category. And a category of workers is workers doing the same work or the same or comparable work as Chris just defined. That information will not need to be made public. But it will need to be available for workers. And as Chris already explained, it's a rather small category. So it's not individual, but it will make a difference to what we know, nowadays, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Look, we'll come on to what do we mean by categories and so on with Ian in a few minutes. But I mean, what we're really talking about here is public disclosure of all, you know, when I say public, even if it's only to employee representatives, of a lot more information than was previously required.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So the third main consequence is what you also already discussed, a shift of the burden of proof. That's not so new. It's very classic, I would say, in discrimination law. But what is new is that there will be an automatic shift of burden. One, if there is a pay gap, and two, if an employer does not report or does not meet the obligations following from the directive. What is also very striking is that confidentiality clauses on pay, which still exists nowadays, can be disclosed if it is in the objective to disclose a pay gap. So that is also, I think a very big difference with what we know nowadays. And then
for confidential information, what struck me was that it basically also stated that a court can order that privilege be lifted from legal advice that has been given to the employer.
Yeah.
Which seems very weird to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. which would be a very, very, very important change for lawyers, like us.
So do I take it from Inger and Chris, from what you're saying, that this is not just, let me say, a technical directive which requires more transparency about equal pay? You're seeing this as a major step change in the whole process.
Yes, yes, employers will practically be forced to work with very transparent categories, wages systems. There will be less, much less possibilities to have individual negotiations. Although the directive says that negotiations are still possible, we think it will be very difficult to work with them because of the measure of transparency that will have to be provided.
Tom, when I was thinking of this, and the more I read it, the less I understand, but that's of course quite often with me. But it either goes the North Korean way, where you're basically going to have categories of workers that are all paid the same, or it goes completely the individualistic way, because you can still make differences on the basis of how much work somebody puts in, etc. But I think it's going to be very difficult. And what struck me is what Amy said. Basically, for me, this is basically also a piece which is going to have a major influence on litigation. With the reversal of the burden of proof, not living up to your requirements on transparency and not being able to explain everything. And the thing is, in life, you cannot explain everything. And even things that are not meant to be discriminatory and that are not discriminatory, you might not have a full explanation for it. And it seems that the directive would require you to do that.
So listen, let me just jump there, because Annie, I know you've got to log off and go and talk to some other people. But let me jump to Ian and say, look, Ian, I mean, you and I have had some conversations about this. And what you've said to me, based on your experience of many years in compensation and benefits, is that, you know, this idea of trying to divide, to identify categories and generate the data, that, you know, it's a lot more complicated than it might look.
Yeah, for sure. Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay, Tom?
Yeah, we can.
No, and I think this is one of these situations. I mean, I agree with what Chris and Ingrid just said. I mean, this is like, you look at this document and you think kind of, oh my God, and it kind of gets really technical pretty quickly. And then you think categorization, and then you kind of step back and think about what happens in the real world. So what I'd like to do, and I think everyone's got the document that I wrote, is that right?
They should have, yes. We circulated it.
Okay. So I'd like to cover four points. The first point is, in my view, the kind of broader context, and other people have touched on this. The second point is maybe some of the compensation details. The third point is kind of how this fits in with what's happened across Europe already. And there's been a bunch of actions, as everybody on this call knows, from France, Germany, most recently Spain, and then kind of what I would suggest that people think about right now, because I think all of us know that this is not going to be transposed into local legislation before when? What, 2023, 2024? So there's time to think about this, but it also fits in really well with the ESG, the environmental social governance focus that there is just about across the world. So if I think about the overall context, the reason this draft exists is that the European Commission is frustrated that after decades, and then the recommendation in March 2014, that was pretty specific, but didn't have rules, that things have not moved. I mean, if you read the document, it says the recommendation has not achieved the objective of the equal pay principle through pay transparency due to its non-binding nature and resulting limited implementation by member states. So what they're trying to do here is force the member states to implement a bit better. And even if you look at what's happened in France, I mean, it would change things. You look at what happened in Spain this year. I know what's happening in Spain. I speak to my network. It's not number 1, 2, 3 or top of the HR priorities, and COVID is not just the excuse. So that's the reason this document exists. It does fit in with, and I think Inga or Chris who talked to that about, you know, wider issues about, you know, female representation on boards, you know, Copies in France, Hampton Alexandra in the UK, and in France just a couple of weeks ago, the new legislation about, you know, going deeper and below that to have at least 40% of people on the executive committee and the reports being women. So it does actually fit in with that pretty well, but it still doesn't seem to be resonating as much as you might think so. Now, the publication by Ursula von der Leyen, when she announced it on the 4th of March, mentioned 14% pay gap. And that was across Europe. And it varies a lot by country for reasons we can probably spend hours debating. And there's the explained pay gap, which is, you know, professions, industries, seniority, etc. But there's still the unexplained pay gap, which is actually really interesting to me. The unexplained pay gap also comes up usually about 3 to 6%. So that's probably going to be one of the focus areas, which will tie into the categorization. And then that takes us to the technical compensation points. And as I go through this, I'm very happy to take questions. So let's get to the disclosure requirements. So as Inger said, there are seven areas. I mean, and it's kind of, I would say the usual areas. It's like, you know, median and average, et cetera, pay gap, et cetera, et cetera, where it really gets interest. And then by quarter by pay band, which is, you know, required in the UK as an example, which I actually find is kind of not that useful metric, but anyway, it's one of the metrics. And then the one that's really interesting is by category. So when I speak with my colleagues in Spain, for example, when that legislation came out, you do it by band or by level. I mean, you could do it by job role, but then it gets super interesting. We see it, it's interesting to see how that gets transposed. But you do it by, you know, by band, right? And then if there's a gap of 5%, you go to this joint assessment, which I think is a really big deal. I mean, 5%. I mean, France, for example, there's a margin of 5% in their calculation that if it's more than 5%, it matters. If it's less than 5%, it doesn't. Now it's 5%. And in Spain, it's 25%, right? So I think this is actually a really big deal. So this is going to require companies to be thinking really carefully about, you know, what their data looks like and what the categories are. And then when it comes to the definition of pay, which is always a kicker here, the definition is really broad. Well, it doesn't include share plans, but it includes, for example, I mean, go beyond, you know, the usual base pay, overtime compensation, benefits, sick pay, etc., pensions. It doesn't include shares, but it doesn't include, like, for pay in case of dismissal. So it's a pretty broad definition. So companies will need to be thinking about that pretty carefully. And I agree with what Chris said. I mean, the cost of implementation, if this actually goes through, I think the word Chris used was ridiculous, and I would agree with that. I mean, it's going to be so much heavier than that. But I mean, let's see what happens. So let me go to, and I'm sure I'm running through my time. I'm going to touch on four countries, and then I'm going to come back to what I would do if I was an HR leader. I will be an HR compensation leader actually in a couple of weeks in regard to this directive. So,
Ian, skip the countries and just focus on what would you do?
Okie doke. What would I do? Okay, so what would I do is I would look at my current landscape, and I'm not sure what data people have. I would wonder about, do I have any current discrimination claims? I would wonder about what I disclosed today to my labor relations partners, because I'm going to have to disclose a ton more tomorrow. I would think about what job categories I feel comfortable about disclosing. And I'm talking about bands and then maybe some of the roles, maybe, because I see in Spain aggregation. And then I would think about, you know, how does all of that fit in with what I'm saying to my workforce and my shareholders about the pay equality practices that I have in place. And I, so I, I would do that, and then I would kind of step back and think about how might that fit in with what happens in 2023 or 2024. But I think it's more a today action.
Okay, so basically, sort of step one is a sort of an audit of what it is you're doing now, and where from that audit are there gaps between what you're actually doing and what this legislation will require you to do. And then what steps you could take to plug those gaps.
Yeah, I think also, Tom, it's like what feels right. I mean, I always come back to what feels right. Are we doing what, you know, is it fair what we're doing today, or is there something we should be doing, and then kind of what's the roadmap to get there?
Okay. Well, let me jump to Alain and Veronique on this, because, you know, clearly, when you listen to what Chris is saying about the law, what you, Chris and Ingrid are saying about the law, when you listen to what Ian is saying about the metrics that we're going to have to start thinking about, and then you have to go and talk to employee representatives about these matters. So what sort of questions do you guys anticipate, based on your own experience, that people are going to be facing?
Yeah.
Which one of you go first?
Yes, it's a very interesting question, Tom. For Coca-Cola, Veronique and myself prepared something just to illustrate what we have done in the past, and Veronique will tell you where the Coca-Cola is now. Just to explain that 11 years ago, I worked also for Coca-Cola, and my last position was VP Employee Relations for Europe. So we worked together with Veronique 11 years ago and 20 years ago even. And what we wanted to show is to that we have to be prepared on that. And that in order to be able to get right data, to have data available, it's a big journey. It's a long journey. So Veronique will illustrate that.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Thank you, Alain. I think I'm not going to spend too much time on presenting the company. We became Euro-Pacific last week, so I have adapted the slide, but I'm going to speak for Europe today. So we have a huge number of countries to in our business, and in Europe we have 11 countries. Much more indeed in a more unionized environment versus Pacific, where I understand it's much more free markets. Maybe if we move to the next slide. I think what we wanted to highlight with Alain is back to some old times, 10 years ago, diversity was already high on the agenda, but at that time we didn't know very much exactly what it meant. So we had quite a lot of working group to define diversity and inclusion. And of course, gender diversity was really the first topic to address. And I think one of the success is really to start defining a journey for a diversity and inclusion. So pay gap and gender pay gap is one of the element of a full diversity plan. Maybe to the next slide. It's a long journey. So at that time we really started to kick off what we want, where did we want to be, the ambition, the action plan, with very strong support from the top. So if we want to start to address those directives, and pay gap is one of the most visible, but I'm very much with Annie. I think it's very important to take that topic in a much broader aspect, to include the woman representation, gender representation, but not only gender, to go beyond with age, potential age discrimination. And now we see a lot of more focus on ethnicity as well in Europe, where we didn't have that before at all. So gender has been the catalyst for more equality. but it's going to trigger obviously more discussion on other areas of diversity.
And do you think Veronique and Didala, do you think that there's a link between these different types of discrimination? So for instance, that you're likely to get, let me put it this way, an older ethnic woman more discriminated against, so that there's several types of discrimination.
I think indeed that's potentially a risk that we could see, and depending on some of the market history and the society of each market, the ethnicity aspect could become an increasing threat in our organization if we don't prepare to that. One of the issues is in Europe, we are not allowed to track ethnicity in the same way country to country. So that's really a concern, because we can't disclose any information because we just don't have the information on ethnicity. We have it in the US or in UK as an example, but clearly in France, in Spain or in Germany, it's much more difficult or even forbidden to track data on ethnicity. So I would say gender is almost the easiest part, because we've got data. It's rough data, but we've got data.
Yeah. Okay. And you're right. And prior to collect data, the idea was to change the mindsets. It's why we launched at that time a lot of initiatives in order to prepare the people, to prepare the manager, the employees, and also the reps across the company in every country.
Right. So I suggest to move to two slides ahead, and exactly to illustrate what Ala is saying, disclosing means that you disclose to who? Not only for legal aspects, but or reputational aspects that can be high, actually, and it can have a high impact on some organization, and like company like us, where reputation is quite high. So it's a very strong strength, but it's also an area where we can be much more attacked as well, and with more damage on our organization. So reputation and managing how we want to disclose is extremely important. And like Alain just said, is we need to get prepared to whom we are going to disclose. So to the authorities, to the external stakeholders, to the board members, to share owners, but as well as to employees and to union reps and employee reps. And my experience and our experience with Alain is that you don't have the same understanding, and yes, and you don't communicate the same way on those, on data, and then on potential gaps, because some of the gaps can be understandable, and some of the gap we can accept. That's fine to have the gaps, because we have meaningful and we have good explanation or good history for the gaps. But to be able to engage all of your partners, understanding data, understanding the gaps, it's another complexity. So I would say that two complexities: first, to establish very strong, robust database reporting aspects, and it's taking time. I think, Alain, it took 2 years for our company to really have a robust data, because you need what Ian said, you need job classification, job banding system, job evaluation, pay grades, pay levels, and not all companies have that luxury to do that. You need a very robust reward system in place, and that system needs to be shared internally with the top management and with the line management. But
let me put a question, and maybe Chris and Inger could come in on this as well. Are we talking, when we say, you know, this legislation applies to companies of more than 250, are we talking about global, or are we talking about site by site? Does that make a difference? Now, what is the 250, and you know, are we looking at that we have to do an analysis by each site? You know, for instance, you and Coca-Cola, European partners, just down the road from me here, you have a big facility in Bear. So do you have to do an analysis for that site and then another one for perhaps somewhere in Marseille or something? Or is it Coca-Cola globally? What do you think on that, Chris and Ingrid?
Well, Tom, if you read the draft now, it refers to the concept of employer only. Mm. And I think it's one of the shortcomings of most of the directives that it doesn't define the concept of undertaking, establishment, employer. So it could be anything. But for me, the most logic thing would be that employer refers to the legal entity employing the people. And so if you have smaller sites than 250, I think you have to take, if they're all within the same legal entity, it might be that you have to take the concept of legal entity and join them all together. Up to now, the danger though, and that's one thing I think that we see increasingly, is that the European Court of Justice, as soon as something is not explicitly defined in the directive, is going to say that it's a European concept and that it comes up with its own definition. So for the moment, I don't know. Ingrid, do you have any more insights in that?
No, there's no definition, as you mentioned. I would think it's something that will have to be defined at local level when implementing the directive, which gives the danger that it will not be the same in all European countries.
It should be, but there you have the danger, I think, that as we have seen with the collective dismissal directive, everything which is not defined at European level, and which honestly I thought for 20 years, like the concept of employee was a local concept, all of a sudden the European Court says not defined at European level, so we define it. And that's a bit of a danger, and that might have to be explained explicitly in the directive, I think. If there's one thing they should do is to clarify this.
So basically, fairly clear from what Chris is saying there, that this stuff is legally unclear. But Veronique, when you approached this issue with Coca-Cola European Partners, did you look at it site by site, or did you look at it on the basis of a whole country?
I think that's a very critical question that you raise, because indeed on a legal standpoint, it's very important, I would say, to stick to the legal entity, like Chris said, because that's a legal definition. And as well, it gives enough size of the pool where you can have good stats. However, we get huge pressure to deep dive, and to deep dive even by function, by department, you know, for the sales population or for production operation population, and as well as by site. But as you go deeper in the analysis, that's where you go down almost to the individual level, and you lose the reliability of the stats, because then it becomes quite anecdotal, and that's where you face individual situation, and it's becoming even more complex to handle. So we do that by country at legal entity level, and potentially go a little bit deeper by type of population. But we try to avoid going in too much detail, because then the devil is in the detail as well, and it's sure. become we lose the reality of the statistics.
Yeah. Ian, what's your experience on how deep do you need to dive?
How deep do you need to dive? Well, so let me pick my Spain experience. I would limit how deep to dive. I would stick more to the kind of equal work for equal value. I would stick to the band level if I could. And if you're a big company, maybe you can go a bit broader. And there's another comment I would make, that the 250 employee by entity, whatever the entity is for the proactive disclosure. I think that no matter how small the employment population is, every single employee who's employed or is going to be employed can actually ask for this data. So I think it actually goes below the 250 bar. But I stand to be corrected by Chris and Inger.
Maybe a question to the group as well on how to manage that at the individual level versus RGPD, and GDPR.
Right. Right. Yeah. And this is a question that's popped up You know, do you think there would be any merit, and I think I might know your answer to this one, Chris, but do you think there would be any merit in trying to agree some sort of a framework with your European Works Council?
You want my honest answer?
Chris, I know your answer. You don't have to. I've known your answer. I've known your answer for 20 years.
Tom, I would say no, because this is going to be, in the end, a purely legal discussion. Huh? And I think how deep you dive in, I would presume in smaller countries, you stick to the legal entity. But I can also presume that in bigger countries, your pay levels are not the same in every single region. Huh?
Yes,
exactly. If a Coca-Cola plant close to Paris, you're bound to be paying more than somewhere in the south, no?
So the deep issue.
Might be some explanation also for some of the gaps, no?
Yeah. Listen, Henry, listening to this from, you know, with American ears, I mean, is this a strange conversation to you, or does it make, you know, is this the sort of conversation that American chief human resource officers would say,
this is a conversation that's had all the time, especially with the comment right there about the plant near Paris and the one in the south. We have that problem. Chief human resource officers have that problem all the time. Somebody working in Manhattan makes more money than somebody working in Nebraska. And I think that what we have in the U.S., we're seeing it worldwide, is a culture of transparency, and companies are continually being asked to provide more data. And I think here in the U.S., the issue is becoming less of one of equal pay and equal work, because that's viewed as a symptom of representation problems. So, you know, it'll be interesting where we can't really pass laws that are going to be viewed as controversial at all in the United States right now. What stakeholder groups are going to engage with companies, how they're going to engage with their employees, to tackle this issue, because this issue is really important to our members. They want to have great representation. They want to have equal pay for equal work. But it's, you know, the Manhattan versus Nebraska comment is something that you have to talk about. That can't be, you cannot pay somebody the same. Well, right now people will say, I can't pay somebody the same in Nebraska as Manhattan. Although there is a company recently, Zillow, I believe, that said, we're going to pay the same no matter where you are.
But Henry, can I put a question to you? What happens, and I'm just, you know, joining some dots together here. Okay. What happens in this new era of remote work where somebody who has been working in Manhattan says, hey, I'm going to remote work from Nebraska and I want my Manhattan salary while I go there?
Well, that was I believe it's Zillow is the firm that decided to address that. And they said, if you work in Nebraska or Manhattan or the Bay Area, we'll pay you the same. So that's one strategy that's being contemplated. And I think employers are going to have to tackle that. I know that there are some small employers that aren't HR policy members that are actually actively redetermining how they're going to staff, because they've been having to pay to be in the Washington DC area, which is a higher salary band. And they found out through COVID that they could have somebody working in southeastern Pennsylvania do the same job, or southwestern Pennsylvania for doing the same job for cheaper. So there may be some employers may take this as an opportunity to say, okay, how do I staff? And it may be pitched to employees as an opportunity for flexibility. I know plenty of people that maybe would like to move out of Manhattan and would like to live in a less expensive area, but maybe feel like they can't because that's where they're tied to. So if it comes to talent management and talent and an employee workforce strategy issue, and we're just really seeing the beginning of those conversations take place, but we're going to see them unfold over the next, I think, 3 to 5 years easily.
Yeah, and does that even bring in the concept of when we talk about equal pay for equal work, and you're just saying, hey, a guy can go or a woman can go from Manhattan to Nebraska, but what about that if they decide to go even further afield and hey, I'll go to Hawaii or I'll go to Thailand or I'll go to wherever, Bali, you know?
Well, from a workforce management standpoint, there are issues with that because some employers may say, well, we still want to have people meet in an office at some time. There are also in the U.S., we have taxation issues, which state is getting unemployment withholding or employment insurance withholding and so on. So there's going to have to be – employers are going to have to consider some limits. But, yeah, it's equal pay for equal work is a simple sounding discussion, but you start talking about working in various locations, even doing the same job. And historically, those have been justifications used by employers to say, we're going to pay this person X amount of money versus X amount of money. Now, the interesting thing about the legislation being considered in the U.S. is that would essentially remove the employer's ability to say, well, we're paying this person because of these factors, and it would have to be a bona fide factor tied to a business necessity. So those are all considerations that employers are going to have to start to consider, are considering now and will consider going forward.
If I come back to Chris and Inger here from a European legal perspective, so I'm a Belgian company. I have an obligation to equal pay for equal work within Belgium, right? But now I suddenly go to a remote working policy, and I allow my employees to start working from wherever they want to work, subject to certain considerations. So there's a geographic consideration now come into play as well in these issues.
Well, the thing is, if geography comes in, you're talking about working in different countries, you're talking about entirely different social security systems also, which means entirely different cost for the employer. So, in my opinion, it should come in. But of course, this is not one of the criteria that's foreseen as objective criteria to determine your equal value of your work. Mm-hmm. But it has to come in, I think. And otherwise, then I come back to the frightening feeling I had of thinking about North Korea that I once visited with this thing of that you have to pay everybody the same when they do a similar job wherever they are in the world, regardless of their costs of living, etc. That sounds to be impossible for me also.
Okay, well, look, we're coming up to the close of this. We've got a minute or two left. Obviously this is, I think what we've just surfaced in the last hour is the complexity, of these issues and the fact that the world is changing so rapidly as a result of COVID, remote working and disaggregation of employment that they've begun to become even more complicated as we go forward. A quick final word from everybody. Inger, what's your final comment on all of this? Plenty of employment for lawyers, yeah?
Sure. Yes, and wait and see what the final outcome of this will be. I wouldn't be surprised if it would be changed substantially. I hope there will be some more consideration on some of the consequences.
Okay, Veronique, from your experience,
from my experience, I would like to take a potential new legislation as an opportunity to accelerate our vision for more inclusion, more equality, more diversity, because, I mean, we feel that it becomes more an acceptable topic. We feel some friction in society, and it's important if we want to keep good attraction of candidates. The story that we are going to tell as employer is very important. So we have to walk the walk and talk the talk. And so, yes, it's going to be difficult to implement, but it's very important that, let's say, we use that as a positive opportunity to accelerate on more gender balance, I would say.
And I presume, Ian, you would say, get the data.
No, I would say yes. Always. And then two other things. One is, I mean, nobody disagrees with this in terms of equality of pay. But the second thing is, and it was, I've seen some of the comments. I mean, if everybody in a company knows what everybody else is paid, I mean, oh my goodness, that has to be managed so carefully.
Okay. Alain?
Yes, yes. As you know, Coca-Cola is a very big company, very well structured with a very strong professional HR team. But it's not the case in other companies. And after Coca-Cola, I work in a French company, a very old one, nearly 400 years seniority. And sometimes it's very difficult in these companies to get efficient and correct data. Usually the payroll is okay, but you have so many different payrolls. And you know, in France, we have at least 20 lines on a pay slip. Even if you want to compliant, you need to get a very strong system, payroll, but also in HRIS. And that would be a great deal for most of the companies.
And I presume, Chris, you would say everything is terrible and it's only getting worse.
No, I would like to stay positive in saying that I think the way our American friends, Henry and Amy and Veronique are saying, we have to work more on diversity, I think.
Okay.
Affirmative action, positive action for women and diverse groups, I think is much more reasonable than this kind of drawing consequences because you cannot fully explain everything.
Okay, so look, we've just run a little minute or two over. Thank you to everybody for what's been a most interesting conversation. I suspect this will be the first of many conversations on this topic as we go forward. You've certainly highlighted the fact that there are issues to be addressed. It's not as simple as it sounds. It's a difficult and complex issue, and it needs to be put in a much wider perspective than just pay alone. So can I thank everybody, to all my colleagues, to Alain, to Inger, to Chris, to Ian, to Veronique, to Henry and to Annie, who's gone on to another call. And also can I thank my colleagues, Mary Murphy, who's been in the background, doing the tech stuff for us, and to my old colleague, Derek, who helped set all of this up with us as well. To those of you who stayed with us, thank you very much. Hope it's been educational, and we'll follow through on all of this. Thanks a lot, and good evening.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.